13. In the wheelchair, the ancient, tattered figure sat huddled in a heavy wool blanket. At first, Nixina did not seem aware of him. He stood by the doorway, waiting. Then at last, the eyes opened. Up from the depths swam a fragment of personality. He saw the consciousness there, in the expression. The coming to the surface from sleep. For her, at her age, sleep was perpetual and natural. It ended only at unusual moments, and before long, it would never end. "Madam," he said. Beside him, an armed attendant said, "Remember, she is deaf. Go closer and she'll be able to read your lips." He did so.
"So, you're going to try again,"
Nixina said, her voice a dry, rasping whisper. "Yes," he said.
"Did you know,"
she whispered,
"that I was along the other times?"
He could hardly believe it. Surely the strain.
"I intend to come this time,"
she told him.
"It's my son, you recall."
Her voice gained sudden vigor.
"Don't you think if anyone can protect him, I can?"
There was nothing he could say to that.
"Helmar built me a special chair," she said,
and in her tone he heard something that told him a great deal. He heard authority. She had not always been old. Once she had been young, not blind and not deaf and not infirm. This woman kept the rest of them going. She did not and would never permit them to stop. As long as she lived, she would keep them at her task, as she had kept her son at the task until the moment of his death. Now her voice sank back to the labored whisper.
"So,"
she went on,
"I'll be perfectly safe. I don't intend to interfere with what you're going to do."
Plaintively, she asked,
"Do you mind? Can you tell me what you think you can do? They say you have a notion that you might do some good."
"I hope so," he said, "but I don't know." He became silent then. There was nothing to tell her, actually. It was all vague. The tired lips moved.
"I will see my son alive,"
she said.
"He starts down the cliff. There's that weapon in his hand. He goes down to kill that man."
Hate and loathing filled her voice.
"That explorer."
Smiling, she shut her eyes and imperceptibly passed back into sleep. The energy, the authority had ebbed away. It could not be sustained now. After a moment, Parsons tiptoed away and out of the room. Outside, Loris met him.
"She's an incredibly strong person," he murmured, still under her spell.
"You told her?"
Loris said.
"There was damn little to tell her," he said, feeling futile, "except that I want to go back."
"Does she intend to try to come this time?"
"Yes," he said.
"Then we'll have to let her. Nobody would go against her decision. You know her. You felt her power."
Loris raised her hands in bitter resignation.
"You can't blame her. We all want to see him. I, Jephthy, the old lady. We get a second to see him in all his glory running down the cliff with that gun. And then..."
She shuddered. Parsons thought, but it's hard to feel sorry for a man who had murder in mind. After all, Corith was on his way down to kill. On the other hand, Drake had certainly sent a good number of heavily armored Spanish soldiers over the side to drown. Weighed down, those men had had no chance. Drake, to them, was simply a pirate. And in a sense, they were right.
"We've made good progress in getting ready,"
Loris said, as they walked together along the corridor.
"We've had more experience now."
Her voice was heavy with despair.
"Do you want to see?"
This time he was permitted to descend to the subsurface levels. At last he had been let in on all that the Wolf Clan had. Nothing was kept back.
"You'll have to go further than the rest of us," Loris said, as they stepped from the lift. "In the way of altering your appearance, because of your white skin. Our problem is one of costume and keeping our equipment out of sight."
Ahead of him stood a group of men and women wearing furs and moccasins.
It was difficult to accept the fact that such primitive-looking people were spurious. With a shock, he identified Helmar among the group. All of them, their faces somber, hair braided back, had an ominous, warlike cast, an air of anger and distrust about them. An illusion, he decided, produced by their costumes. The burnished red of their skin glowed in the artificial light that reflected throughout this subsurface chamber. That was natural, the fine, impressive red. He glanced at his own arms. How different he felt from them. What a contrast.
You'll be all right, Loris said. We have pigments.
I have my own, he said, in my instrument case.
By himself in a side room, he removed all his clothing. This time, he rubbed the pigment onto every part of him. He did not leave the telltale middle area white, as he had before. Then, with the help of several servants, he dyed his hair black.
That isn't enough, Loris said, entering the room.
Startled, he said, I haven't got anything on.
He stood naked, the reddish pigment drying on him, with the servants braiding artificial hair into his to give length to it. Loris, however, did not seem to care. She paid scarcely any attention to him.
You must remember your eyes, she said. They are blue.
With contact lenses, the pupils of his eyes were given a dark brown cast.
Now look at yourself in the mirror, Loris said.
A full-length mirror was produced, and Parson studied himself in it. Meanwhile, the servants began to dress him in the furs. Loris watched critically, seeing to it that each part of his garments was placed on him properly.
How about it? He said.
The man in the mirror moved when he moved. He had trouble accepting the image as his, this frowning, bare-armed, bare-legged warrior with his coppery skin, his greasy-looking uncut hair falling down the back of his neck.
Fine, Loris said. It isn't important that we be authentic, but that we fit the 16th century English stereotype of Indians. They're the ones we have to deceive. They kept several armed scouts posted here and there on the cliffs overlooking their careened ship.
What's the relationship between Drake's party and the local Indians? Parsons asked.
Evidently good. He has been plundering Spanish ships to his heart's content, so there is plenty of valuable material aboard. No need of ravaging the countryside. To him and his men, the California coast area has no value. He's there because after he successfully plundered the Spanish ships near Chile and Peru, he went north seeking a passage to the Atlantic.
So, in other words, Parsons said, he's not there for conquest, at least not against the Indians. It's been other whites that he's preyed on.
Yes, she admitted. And now that you are all ready, I think we had better be getting back to the others.
As they walked back to join the group, Loris asked,
in case of emergency, you're familiar enough with the controls of our time ship so that you could operate it?
I hope so, he said.
Loris said,
you can be killed there in Nova Albion.
Yes, he said, thinking of the lifeless figure floating and drifting silently, unchangingly in the cold pack.
And, he thought, if anything went wrong, if we're not able to get back to our own centuries, we would be catching abalone and mussels, living on elk and deer and quail. These people could extol the virtues of Indian culture, but certainly they themselves would be unable to endure it. With an eerie awareness, he thought, they would probably try to get back to England with Drake's men. And, he thought, so would I. The plate of Brassa, which Drake's men had left on the California coast, had been found 40 miles north of San Francisco Bay. The Golden Hind had cruised up and down a considerable part of the coast before Drake, an expert and provident seaman, had found a harbor that suited him. The ship needed its rotten planks repaired, its bottom breamed, for the voyage across the Pacific and back to England. It was loaded with enormous treasure, enough to transform the economy of the home country. To ensure safety for the men and ship during the careenage, Drake needed a harbor that would give him as much privacy and freedom as possible. At last, he found the harbor with white cliffs, fog much like the Sussex coast that he knew so well. The ship was brought into the Estero, its cargo removed, and the careening begun. Standing on the cliff, several miles from the Estero, Jim Parsons watched the work through high-powered prismatic binoculars. Ropes from the ship trailed out into the water, where they were attached to stakes driven deep and out of sight. The ship, on its side, lay like some injured animal washed up onto the beach, helpless and unable to get back to its element. Out in the water, several winches controlled the angle of the ship. The seamen at work replacing rotten planks stood on a wooden platform that kept them, at high tide, above the water level. Through his binoculars, Parsons saw them working with what appeared to be pots of tar or pitch. Fire smoldered beneath the pots, and the men carried the tar to the side of the ship by means of broom-like poles. The men wore cloth trousers rolled up and cloth shirts washed a light blue. Their hair in the warm midday sun shone yellow. To his ears came the distant, faint noises of their voices. He saw no sign of Drake himself. Surveying the Estero, Parsons tried to recall what had become of this region in his own time. A subdivision of tract houses called Oko Village, named after the 20th century realtor who had financed it, and a resort frontage along the water's edge, private beaches and boats. "Where is Drake?" he said, crouching down beside Helmar and Loris and the others in their fur wrappers. "Off somewhere in a dinghy," Helmar said. "Scouting." Behind them, the ship had been hidden among trees, covered with shrubbery and branches to disguise its metal exterior. Now, as Parsons glanced back at it, he saw that they were bringing out the old woman in her chair. With her was her daughter, Jephthy, the wife of her son. The old woman, wrapped in a black wool shawl, complained in a shrill, peevish voice as the chair bumped over the uneven ground. "Can't she be kept more quiet?" he said softly to Loris.
"This excites her," Loris said. "They won't hear."
Sound travels up here because it's reflected by the water and cliffs. She knows that she has to be careful. The old woman, as her chair neared the cliff edge, became silent.
"What are we supposed to do?"
Loris said to Parsons. He said, "I don't know." He did not know what he himself was supposed to do. If he could sight Drake. "You're sure he's not aboard the ship?" he said. With a sardonic twitch of his lips, Helmar said, "Look along the cliff." Turning his glasses, Parsons saw, hidden among the rocks, a small group of figures, red arms, shiny black hair, the gray fur of their garments, both men and women.
"Ourselves," Helmar said hoarsely, "the previous time."
In the binoculars, Parsons saw a woman rise up slightly, a powerfully built woman whose strong neck glistened in the heat. Her head turned and he recognized Loris. And further along, also perched in a declivity of rock, another group. Through the glasses, he once more identified Loris and, with her, Helmar and the others. Beyond that, he could not see. He said to Loris beside him,
"Where is your father?"
"He left Nixina and Jephthy at the timeship,"
she said tonelessly.
"He made them wait there while he started along the cliff. For quite a time, they lost sight of him. When he reappeared, he had changed to his costume, and he was about one-third of the way down the face of the cliff. He disappeared behind some rocks, and then..."
Her voice broke. Presently, she resumed.
"Anyhow, they saw him jump up just for a second and go over head first with a yell. Whether the arrow had gotten him at that point, we don't know. They next saw him roll down until he came to rest against a shrub growing from the face of the cliff. They hurried to the edge and managed to get down to him. And of course, when they got to him, they found him with the arrow in his heart."
Now she ceased talking. Helmar finished.
"They saw no one else. But of course, they were too busy trying to get the ship close enough to get him into it. They managed to land the ship on the cliff face, using its jets to support it until they had him inside."
"Was he dead?" Parsons asked.
"Dying," Helmar said matter-of-factly. "He lived for several minutes, but he wasn't conscious."
Loris touched Parsons' arm.
"Look down again," she said.
Again, he studied the Estero far below. A small boat with five men in it had appeared from the far side of the careened ship.
Methodically, it moved along with four of the men working long oars. The fifth man, bearded, had some kind of metal instrument in his hand. Parsons saw it glint in the sun. The man was Drake. Yes, Parsons thought. But was it Stenog? He saw only the head, the beard, the man's clothes. The face was obscured and too far away. If that is Stenog, he said to himself, then this is a trap, a fake. They are waiting, and they have weapons as good as ours. What weapons do they have? He asked. Loris said, we understand that they have cutlasses, of course, and wheel-lock rifles, or possibly the older matchlock rifles. It is possible that some rifles have spiral grooves in the barrels, but that's only conjecture. They can't possibly fire this far, in any case. There are a few cannon, removed from the ship, or at least we assume there are. We have seen none on the beach, however. And if they're still aboard the ship, they certainly can't be fired, not with the ship on its side. They took everything possible off to lighten the ship, so it would draw the least water. In any case, they have never fired on us, either with hand weapons or cannon.
They didn't have to, Parsons thought.
At least not with the weapons that Loris supposed. He said aloud, so Corith went down the cliff assuming he was not in jeopardy.
Yes,
she said.
But Drake's men wouldn't be using an Indian weapon, would they?
The doubt, the bewilderment showed in both her voice and face. This catastrophe made no sense to her. Now, as before, it was beyond them. With the information they had, they could not deal with it.
And why would a native kill him?
Loris demanded. Below them, a small boat had begun pushing away from the Golden Hind. It moved gradually to the south in their direction. Presently, it would pass directly beneath their spot. Parsons said, I'm going down. Handing her the binoculars, he took the coil of rope that they had brought and began lashing one end to a well-secured rock. Helmar helped him, and together they got the rope tight. Then, taking the coil, Parsons started away from the group. Almost at once, he realized that he could not descend directly. Even if the rope were long enough to let him down to the beach, he would be conspicuous, dangling against the white cliff. The men in the boat would be aware of him. Leaving the rope, he scrambled back up to the top of the cliff and began to run. Ahead of him, he made out a deep cleft, overgrown with shrubbery, a tangle of broken rocks and roots that dipped out of sight beneath him. Catching hold, he crept down, step by step. Below, the Pacific seemed perfectly flat, spread out as far as the eye could see. The ocean and the cliffs, nothing else. The blue of the water, the crumbling rock in his hands as he clawed his way down. Now, for an instant, he caught sight of the small boat once more, the men rowing. Ribbon of sand with foam and breakers, driftwood washed up. The disorderly collections of seaweed. He stumbled and almost fell. Head first, he hung, clutching at roots. Rocks and bits of shrubbery rained past him, falling somewhere. He could hear the sound echo. Far below, the boat continued on, silently. None of the tiny figures seemed to hear or notice. Parsons, by degrees, righted himself. Facing the cliff, not looking at the ocean below, he again descended. When next he halted, getting his wind, he saw that the boat had come closer to shore. Two of the men had gotten out and were wading in the surf. Had they seen him? Swiftly, he made his way down. The rock surface became smooth. He clung for an interval, and then, taking a deep, prayerful breath, he released his grip and dropped. Beneath him, the sand rose. He struck and fell, his legs thrashing with pain. Rolling, he slid down among the seaweed and lay, wheezing, enduring the gradually declining numbness of impact. The boat had been dragged up onto the shore. The men were searching for something on the beach, kicking at the sand. Some lost tool or instrument, Parsons thought. He lay stretched out, watching. One of the men came toward him, and after him, Drake. Both men passed directly in front of Parsons, and as Drake turned, Parsons saw his face clearly, outlined against the sky. Scrambling up, Parsons said, Stenog! The bearded man turned, His mouth fell open with astonishment. The other men froze.
You are Stenog, Parsons said.
It was true. The man stared at him without recognition. Don't you remember me? Parsons said grimly. The doctor who cured the girl Ikora? Now recognition came. The expression on the bearded man's face changed. Stenog smiled. Why? Parsons wondered. Why is he smiling?
They got you out of the prison rocket, did they?
Stenog said.
We thought so. One dead Shupo and two unidentified corpses out of nowhere, sealed in and traveling back and forth.
His smile grew, a knowing, confident smile.
I'm surprised to see you. You completely threw me off.
How interesting. You, here. His white, even teeth showed. He had begun to laugh.
Why are you laughing? Parsons demanded.
Let's see your friend, Stenog said. The one who's going to do the killing. Send him down.
He put his hands on his hips, his legs wide apart.
I'm waiting.